Okay, folks, so welcome back, or welcome, depending on whether you're with us this morning or not. We had a wonderful morning of talks by Joe Mesarov and Ken Staley here, and we're going to return now to three more talks by Shaolin Meng, Deborah Mayo, and Mark Vanderland here. At the end, at 4:30, when the talks are done, what we have planned is an hour of period for discussion. So we're going to have our speakers come up here and give you a chance, if you have questions that you haven't had a chance to ask them in limited time after their talks. Or what we're particularly hoping is if there's sort of larger, broader issues that you feel have come out of today's talks that you'd like to see discussed and you'd like to hear all the speakers sort of giving their opinion on it, this is going to be the time that we hope that happens. Okay. To get us going now here for the afternoon session, it's my pleasure to be able to introduce Shaolin Meng to you. Again, in the spirit of trying to not take up too much of our speakers' time listing their honors here, I'll just briefly say that Shaolin is currently Dean of Harvard's Graduate School of Arts and Sciences, the Whipple V.N. Jones Professor, and formerly Chair in Harvard's Department of Statistics. He was before Harvard at the University of Chicago for 10 years as well. He's very, very well known in the statistics community as contributing both the theoretical foundations, which we thought was particularly appropriate here, but also methodology and also applications across a range of different applications. He is a winner of the 2001 Committee of Presidents of Cisco Societies Award. For those of you in mathematics, that's like a quarter of a Fields Medal. Mathematicians give it every 4 years. We give it every year, but it counts for no less. He's an elected fellow of the Institute of Mathematical Statistics and the American Cisco Association, and also a 2010 Medallion Lecturer for the IUS. So without any further ado, shall we?
Thank you very much, Eric. I truly appreciate this invitation because, you know, over the years I've given many, many talks, but this is the first time I give a talk in front of real philosophers. And for me, that I think that I see some my students here that I'm very happy to see them, because I truly believe statisticians really should think more about the philosophical foundation for what we're doing. Now, I do find myself increasingly thinking more about what we're doing, and I realize probably that's a sign of aging, as you know, that when you're getting older, you start asking questions about the meaning of life, and this is a similar thing I've been asking myself more about, what are we doing? As you all know, that putting a very concrete way, what was statistician trying to do is not only trying to make an educated guess of, you know, anything we don't know, but we're even trying to measure, you know, how educated we are in the sense of the uncertainty quantity. And this talk I want to give is really designed for this conference. Initially, when Eric invited me, I said, great, this is something I wanted to work on. Actually, has actually a very good connection with what Eric works on. He probably did not know that yet. I was inspired by wavelets, so this is where, you know, Eric has done many work on it. This is also a rare occasion that I can give a talk based on two papers. They just come out. Both of them just come out. The first one is really a discussion that's been turning almost into paper, which is the example I'm going to use today on Simpson paradox, which statisticians should all know it. Otherwise, you shouldn't claim yourself a statistician. And others, I'm sure you're aware of. You may not know that name, but once I show you that, it's a pretty common phenomenon. The other paper I wrote just come out has a provocative title called A Trail of Inference Problems That Could Win You Your Nobel Prize in Statistics. As you know, such a thing does not exist, which is but the American Statistical Association actually is trying to raise money, so I hope this will help them. The three inference problems I talk about there, I will talk about one of them today, which is the multi-resolution inference, and I explain to you what do I mean by that. The other two actually were well illustrated by Joe's talk this morning. One is called multi-phase inference, which is currently now, we all have these big data, but anyone analyze, ever use big data, you would know the data you have are never the original data. it has gone through so many processes, so many people trying to clean it, you know, renormalize it, you know, collaborate it. So you need to know what they're doing. And even everybody made the best effort, you may still have what I call an uncongeniality issue, that these models are not consistent with each other. Another problem is what I call the multi-source problem. Jill's talk also illustrated is you have data from all different sources, and you're trying to integrate them. What I came from was really from Census Bureau. You have all these data from administrative data, which were never collected for inference whatsoever. It was collected because it's required by law. So now you think about, you know, how do you analyze those data? And I gave that talk at a statistical conference, and I asked the audience the following question. I'm going to try that question on you as well. Suppose you have a randomized sample. You have 5% of the population, say, it's truly randomized. And you have 85% administrative data. Nobody tells you anything how they were collected. Which one you would trust more? It's a yes or no answer. 5% random or the 85 non-random sample? 85 non-random sample.
Assuming that the randomization is solid relative to your needs for the measurement, and the sample set size is big enough, I would take that any day, because you know what the biases are. They're hopefully done.
Well, actually, most officials in the conference answered they want the 85%. You know, non-random one. I was shocked. It turned out the 85 could be terrible. Maybe even 99% for exactly what you're saying. But that's another talk, and I shouldn't talk other talks. I should have gone with this talk. So, what does big data mean for you? And before I do that, sorry about that. I have to mention that this is joint work with my great student Kelly Liu, and by joint work I means that, you know, he works really, literally, almost 23 hours a day, and I join whenever I can find a few minutes. And so this is truly, he has been truly remarkable that preparing everything, including the content itself. So let me just start by asking the question, right? What does big data mean for you? Well, that the you here mean you as an individual. That, you know, these days you hear all sorts of things about, you know, individualized here, you know, this and that, and the idea is with a lot more data we probably can see you more clearly. Sometimes you like that, sometimes you don't. And what are the things that these days that has been, you know, buzzword, you know, individualized medicine? We probably like that because we like to be treated at the condition we have, not treating some average people, right? And by the time you have a disease, who cares about the average person? I care about me. And then you have, you know, people talk about individualized education, that has been something pretty big. Then there are things started we probably don't like, but they would do it anyway. You know, there's this thing called individualized news. The idea is that they will track what you're watching on your iPhone to design the news program for you as you like. I'm not sure if I like that, because I probably will be very biased. My view of the world will be keeper. And probably the one we will like least, but the companies love it, is the individualized marketing, right? They try and find what you like to buy, they give you all the ads. But whatever it is these are things you use lots of statistics, right, to do this individualized study. But when I first thought about this, I was saying, what's the foundation of doing this at all, right? Because the whole idea of statistics, at least the classical statistics, is about replication, is about infer a population from a sample. What do we mean by individualized? Sample size one, right? So where's replication, where's anything that allows to do anything, right? So the good news, bad news here is that, you know, the gift and the curse of the big data is the treatment for you based on the data, but based only on data from people like you. The curse is no one is perfectly like you. Right, so if you take this seriously, really at the foundational level, you start thinking about what is a statistical inference for individualized treatment, any of those things. What are we doing? Right? What, you know, what's the foundation here? And we do it all the time. And so that's a question I want to address here. It's not a new question at all. In fact, Ken quoted, we did not coordinate it, but this is a This, Charles Peirce said long time ago, right, centuries ago, that no two different objects are alike in all respect. But one, it is obviously true, but it has no bearing on induction, where we deal with object which we well known are like all existing things, alike in numberless respects, and unlike in numberless other respects. So the bottom line here is really the question is, how do you define individual? And that's really a philosophical question. And I think truly that's a philosophical question. So I wanted to say a little bit of what this multi-resolution idea is. How do I think about, from a statistical perspective, to approach this this issue of defining individuality? I'm not trying to define philosophically. We have real philosophers here can tell you. But rather, in practice, when you work on those things, that it actually matters. It's not just a philosophical debate. It's about identifying the relevant population for which you can do some analysis. Then you believe that can be transferred to that individual, which hopefully is not you, but if you need to be treated, that's what you need to worry about. Okay. So let me actually start with this, I have a little fun here, painful question, because I'm going to use this example of kidney stone, which is the example Kelly and I used in that first paper on Simpson paradox. The reason we use that is because we have a data set, which is a pretty well-known data set in the literature of Simpson paradox, is about a kidney stone, which I'm going to show you in a minute. But imagine you're a doctor. Not PhDs, but real medical doctor, right? And treating a patient, and the patient comes in, say, I'm suffering. And by the way, how many of you suffer kidney stones? All right. Kidney stone is extreme painful. Okay, don't have it. If a patient comes in, there's always two choices of treatment, at least two choices. Even if there's only one drug, there's still two choices. The other choice is not treating the patient. So if you think about treatment, there's always at least two treatments, right? So the question here is obviously, if you're a doctor, you want to treat the patient, you say, which one will work better for my patient? The very question you ask, which one is better, you already ask a philosophical question. It's a counterfactual question. Because you can only treat the patient by one treatment, right? What you really want to know is if I give treatment A and I give them a treatment B, which will have a better outcome? But you can only take one, right? So in order to make this decision, you really have to do something else, because you cannot try to both out and say, hey, you should do that one because you already treated, right? So what are the real questions here that we statisticians should ask? The first question is really the ideal question. If I could have all the data I want, how will we make a treatment decision? What I mean by that, well, imagine you can find all the people just exactly like Miss Payne, and then you collect all the data on their past treatment, all the options. If you can think of ideally what kind of data you want, but in reality you never have those data, right? So given the actual data, the question of estimation, given the actual data, what quantity is needed for the ideal decision-making process that we can actually estimate, and what quantities we cannot? Right? But that's actually not the only two questions. The third question is really the inferential question, right? Given the information constraint, given whatever data you have, how do we best approximate the ideal decision-making process by an achievable one? So that's the question. There are lots of different ways of estimating, right? How do we know which one is the best given all the constraints we have? So here are really the three questions. What we're trying to argue here is that these different questions actually really have a different resolution. Now, I haven't introduced the concept of resolution yet, but I'm going to give you the following wavelets, the 1 minute introduction to wavelets, and see how this is how I was inspired of thinking about this problem. So what is the wavelets? Well, you can have, Erica can tell you everything about the wavelets, and here is something, very, very quick. And just imagine, is this the one? Okay, so suppose this is the picture you have. Clearly there seems some signal, and there's some noise, and the wavelet essentially is equivalent to representation of this picture, but on this sort of frequency and the location jointly. These are different coefficient represents, you know, different frequency. So you can think about these are the low frequency one, these are high frequency one. The low frequency one is trying to capture these are big sort of, you know, movement, and the high frequency one is really trying to capture these high frequency one. Okay, so what does wavelets you know, literature, these methods do? People say, well, it looks like there are lots of you know, noises here. What I like to do is to remove these noise and to recover maybe the underlying signal, right? So the way that people do it is, for example, there's famous work, and I think Eric contributed quite a bit, about it called the thresholding. You basically say, oh, look at all these frequencies. I believe these low frequencies are real signal. Some high ones, they're noise. I'm going to cut them into zero. I so-called the shrink them, right? So you threshold, you set them equal to zero, then you do the inverse transformation. Between them is simply a matrix transformation if you do these discrete wavelets, right? Then you recover this. Okay, the idea is now all the high frequency ones go. You don't exactly, you know, recover everything perfectly. In fact, this one was generated by this. This was the original sort of, you know, signal. This was in the famous paper, Donahoe Johnston's paper, and they added some noise. This was the original waves representation here. There's no noise. Okay, at least intended there's no noise. And this was a noisy version. And then you do the transformation. You cut off some zeros. How do you cut off these high frequency ones? Is the entire industry and doing hard thresholding, soft thresholding, all sorts of ways, and then of course you recover this, right? So the reason I mentioned this is for two reasons. That traditionally, at least up to very recently, right, most of us do statistical inference is to thinking about, well, here is my noise version, how do I recover this sort of perfect one? You can think about this as like a population average, if you had many, many of these versions, okay? And you use this as intent to be estimate of this. But when you come to the individualized medicine, it's a reverse inference problem. Actually, this is what I'm interested in. This is me. This is a me that have all my idiosyncratic, little noises. What I can learn is from a population will be something like this, by averaging of a bunch of other people. So the inference problem is no longer about inferring this. I don't care about the average person in a population. I care about me. So the question is really now, how do you think about inference is infer this one? How do we go from here to here, instead of going from to that, right? So what is the resolution analogy? Well, what makes me is because of all my little deviations from some population. You can think about, if I have a train, we may share something common. If you're in a family, the signal is getting sort of, higher, lower resolution, right? And if you think about, this is sort of a schematic a representation of what we want to do. So the idea what we're here thinking about is, no one will be exactly like you. The idea is, how are you going to lower the resolution? Your resolution is too high. You lower your resolution enough that you can find people, statistically speaking, is exchangeable. Therefore, you can learn from that population, then say, well, that's good enough approximation. Right? Okay. So the big question here is, how do you find what the wavelets literature will be called the primary resolution? Actually, another really important thing to realize here that it all depends on the notion of signal and the resolution. Signal and the noise are completely relative, right? In this case, we may have decided. Looks like we have decided everything above here. We will think about seven, actually lower than seven resolution. We think that's a signal. Everything above will be called a noise. But someone could decide another level. Right. So, what is called a resolution? What called the signal? What called a noise? Is all relative. So, the idea here is how do you define the resolution that is good enough to approximate that the individual decision, and also it's feasible for having enough data to estimate. Right. Okay. So now let me give you this kidney stone example. That's how we actually started. So this example was from this particular study in a British Journal of Medicine, that if you only look at the abstract, right? The abstract tells you Actually, we're trying to compare the treatment A and B. I will tell you in a minute what, you know, what they are. But if you only read the abstract, which is entirely possible because when you're in pain, you probably only have the time to read the abstract. If the doctor reads the abstract to make the decision, or you like to make a choice, I think it's no brainer, you're going to choose treatment B, right? If that's all the information you have. If that's all the information you have, if you choose treatment A, then we probably need to examine where the stone is. Probably it's in your brain, right? Because why should I choose one with the lower success rate? What's interesting that if you actually read the paper, this is also a great example, don't just read the abstract. Read the actual paper. Inside the actual paper, you will find in a complicated table that once they divide by small stone and the large stone, then suddenly treatment A become better, right? And this is what's well-known called the Simpson paradox. It confuses lots of people, say, how could that happen? Should I go with treatment B or go to treatment A? And, you know, the reason given all the fractions, you see there's no sleight of hand, there's no arithmetic error, it's everything adds up, right? And of course that, you know, for any statisticians or anyone who have thought about this phenomenon, it's quite clear that what happened here is, although there were 350 patients in each group, this couldn't possibly, or it has a very small probability, this was a randomized trial. There's a huge confounding factor. Yes.
There could be either hidden variables.
Yes. We will get that. That's a great one. But this one, actually, read the paper, you will see. They acknowledge, they collected clinical data over the 14 years period without any clinical trial, you know, protocol, right? So what happened is the one easy explanation, which probably is the one responsible for this thing, is that there's a strong confounding factor between the size of stone and the treatment given, right? The treatment B was given to all this mostly small stone, which is easier to treat. Treatment A was given to the large stone, which is harder to treat. So when you combine them, that, you know, the treatment B in the combining pool, that the small stone, the easy case dominates. That's come up with those things, right? Okay, so what's the relevance to what I want to, what I want to talk about? Well, you think about if you make a decision without condition on the size of the stone, that's like what we call resolution zero, because you are not using any covariates. Okay? And you can think about using the size of stone is like, you know, I'm going to look at someone, the stone size is like my size. So you're adding one attribute. That's like, make a resolution a little bit higher. You basically make the people you compare to smaller and the smaller as you're adding resolution level. Okay? So that's a simple analogy here. And of course, it turns out that the treatment A was open surgery. You can see open surgery is really, works for particularly for large stone. And the other one is this unpronounceable treatment. Essentially, it's some non-invasive treatment that works better for, not works better for small stones, but actually was applied mostly to the small stone because, you know, doctor, when they treat you, they don't flip a coin, right? They don't flip a coin and say, for the sake of science, I'm going to flip a coin. They would give you one they think will best work for you. Later we will come back to this example, but I will give you a twist on this particular example. But here in this case, probably most of you would agree this was easy to explain because you have this confounding factor. Okay? So I already said that, so I can move very quickly. Although you think you're comparing these two groups, you're really comparing apples with oranges because one has a lot more small stones, one has large stones. So the fundamental question here is what went wrong was that why Simpson paradox happens is the population you think you're comparing the treatment is really not the sort of fair comparison. So, but the problem is often what we see in the data is that we see something apparent. For example, now if I ask a question, are Mark and Ben similar? If I show you this, of course, you know they're both without any hair, very similar. But what if I told you that this was a post-treatment observation that actually, let's say they both went through chemotherapy, that before the treatment, one actually had a lot more data, right? This almost looked like my hairstyle, right? So now you would know that if I really want to condition on the person similar to me, I probably, what depends on, pre-treatment condition is more important than the post-treatment condition. Now, in the statistical literature, particularly in causal inference, you will see lots of debates about, this was what our paper trying to help to think about this problem. There are lots of debates about whether should a condition on, what you should condition on, and I think most people would agree, don't condition on anything after the treatment because you have all sorts of confounding factors. You should condition pre-treatment. What we're trying to say in this paper is that the post-treatment variables are actually useful because they help you to predict, to actually back sort of predict what the pre-treatment conditions were if you know how to do that. So in fact, you can still condition on the post-treatment variables, but you don't condition on them directly. You condition on them after some processing. That's what we're trying to do in this paper. Along the way, we illustrate that thinking about the resolution really, really helps to do this. So the emphasis here is, it's a very simple one. You want to compare apples with apples, but you want to compare apples with apples in the intrinsic way. So we want, the emphasis here is that individual apparently similar may be intrinsically dissimilar, but now there's also a real question here, what do we mean by intrinsic similarity? And that's where we get it really a little bit into the philosophic definition of what's the individuality. So let's take another look of this kidney stone example. Let's say this time, instead of previously was whether treatment was successful or not for removing the stone. Suppose I change the problem a little bit. Suppose this time the treatment is to relieve the pain, not to remove the stone. Let's suppose you cannot find a doctor to do that right away, but you need medication to reduce reduce your pain. And this time, it's the exact same data set. Of course, this is not real anymore because we have changed the condition. But this time, if I tell you that this was actually a randomized trial, this was completely randomized. The reason you see the stone size with this imbalance is because the stone size was measured post-treatment. Okay? So it's exactly the same table. But the reason is now we know these treatments actually will affect the stone size. Some reduce the pain by reduce the size of the stone. Okay? So if this is the case, now if I ask you that if you have a particular condition, how the doctor should use this data to inform the decision? Okay? So then first you would say, well, I cannot use this data because I have not been treated. How do I know the size of my stone after treatment? But the doctor will have a measure of the stone before the treatment. Okay? For example, before your treatment, the stone may be small. And the doctor knows no medication can increase the size of the stone. They would actually know that your size of stone that after the treatment will be still small. Right? So if that's the case, should I use this one? Should I use this as a comparison? Or should I be careful with that? Okay, so that's the question we want to address. Okay, so now let me give to we're trying to be philosophical here, or rather, Kaylee's trying to be philosophical here, so you will see some reference here. We really want to define the individual, or actually we want to use this definition, right? So we're going to really use this little face. We were debating for an audience like this, we used to use a mathematical notation. We decide a little face probably works better. Okay, a little face is an individual, right? Okay, so the question is, how do we define an individual? One question, how do we distinguish two individuals, right? Okay, so one way people would do is say, well, let's measure a bunch of characteristics of the individual, their height, their weight, their medical history, where they live, all sorts of things. But once you start doing that, you realize you can never truly measure everything, right? So there will be always somewhere, this is what we call resolution, right? Somewhere you will have to stop. So what we wanted to do is that, say, suppose we have some measured characteristics which we can think of them as intrinsic characteristic. In which case, that if they differ from those things, then we can say they are intrinsically dissimilar. But the problem is that you actually do not really observe these. Some of them you can observe, say your chronological age or your agenda, but some of the measures that you may or may not be able to measure, that they actually will be influenced by the treatment. For example, in the previous example, that the stone size. Suppose you forgot to measure the stone size before the treatment, you only measured afterwards. Then what you observed is not something intrinsic to the treatment, but rather is affected by that treatment. So mathematically, in order to distinguish this, we have to say you have a product space in the sense that knowing one does not eliminate the possibility of having the other. So what we're trying to do is really say how much we can learn from these sort of non-intrinsic similarity to infer the underlying intrinsic similarity for which we can condition on to make the sort of apple versus apple, you know, comparison. Okay? So one way to define intrinsic characteristic is saying that, you know, whatever measure, end of any treatment, that characteristic will not change. Okay? That would be intrinsic. For example, when you have open surgery to take out the stone size, that you probably think about that stone size is intrinsic because the treatment moved the whole stone but did not change the size. Not like taking some medication. Okay? So this is just what I said. Right? If it's open surgery, you may think about the stone size is sort of intrinsic. But if the medication can reduce the size, then of course, if you are doing the post-treatment measurement, the size is no longer intrinsic. Okay. So what we want to do is we really want to think about how you set up the population that is relevant for you to think about these individualized the treatment. Now, in order to do that, you have to invoke, I think this is a very familiar term in statistics, is called potential outcome. I'm sure that concept is very familiar in any sort of philosophy, of science. So the idea is to think about that if you were given treatment one or given two, what would be the outcome? You would never get both of them. What you observe is really, you can mathematically represent as like a mixture of the two, right? It's not a real mixture, it's a linear combination in a way. You know, if you get a treatment one, then you get this one. If you get a treatment zero, you will get the other one. This is just for the sake of the notation. As I already mentioned, the non-intrinsic, the post-treatment kidney stone side is non-intrinsic. But here is something that is intrinsic. At least philosophically, you can think about it this way. Even I have never given the treatment one to a particular person, say me, the stone size and the treatment one is an intrinsic characteristic to me. You know, whether I get it or not, you can think about, hypothetically, there will be a treatment, there will be a stone size after that treatment, if you get it. And that does not treat, that size does not change regardless of which treatment I'm getting. What's changed is which one I get observed. There's a stone size intrinsic to treatment one, there's a stone size intrinsic to treatment zero, these two treatments. What we observe, whether we observe which one does not change these two numbers, it just changes which one we get to observe. Okay, and that's an important distinction to make. So just statistically thinking about analyzing data, and it's useful to remind people, and particularly for me because I come from this sort of missing data perspective. You can think about this is a treatment assignment. You got a zero treatment. Let's say it's the control group. This is the treated group. Or you think about treatment A versus B. Let's say these are all the measures that are common that will be measured for any patient in your trial or even in your study. It could be age. It could be something that everybody measures. But then you also have those things that are only measured if you get treatment zero, or you only measured if you get treatment one. Therefore, these cross ones you will never observe because they are, once they get only treatment zero. For example, you will never get, if you get the treatment zero, you can only measure the treatment, the stone size and the treatment zero. You will never know what's the stone size and the treatment one. But what's interesting is that the treatment size and the stone, the stone size and the treatment one is relevant for predict how well these treatment will work for you. So that's why it's a relevant piece of information that you need to keep. So the fundamental question here is really that if you were this patient, that what you want to do is to find out what is the relevant population for me, right? So you can define, if you have set of intrinsic similarity, intrinsic characteristics that you feel comfortable to use, you certainly can define these individuals that are those that share these same characteristics. And now here we will be using a very crude measure of resolution. I'm sure this one will have lots of problems, but for this talk or for the paper we wrote, this was good enough. You can think about a C is just the dimension of how many covariates you are using. The more covariates you are using, the higher resolution it is. So it's as an approximation to the resolution level. So now the job is like, you know, say this is your, you know, that the waveless representation of you. These are all sorts of individuals, right? And every one of them, if you look too deep in the resolution, you will find they're different. So what you need to decide is where I'm going to cut, we put R, this is like the resolution level, where I'm going to take the primary resolution that we can say, well, at least for the low resolution, these characters there can be shared, and I'm going to ignore the rest of them, because these high frequency ones, probably their impact on the treatment is negligible. Because if not, you have a problem. Right, so this is my analogy using the wavelets literature. Is we do think about defining what is the relevant population for you is almost like finding the prime resolution for which you can declare everything else is just noise. Okay. Of course, this is all depends on all sorts of, you know, model assumptions. You would do that, right? So now let's look at what's the ideal question, right? The ideal question say, what we want to really know, which we probably can never know directly, is that if we give you the treatment 1, what's your outcome? If you give a treatment, if you give you treatment, you know, there's a two different 1 as 0, sorry about that. If you give a treatment 1, what is the outcome? It could be 1 success, 0 failure. If you give a treatment 0, it could be 1 success, 0 failure. What you want to know is this difference, right? If I know this difference, then I would know how to give you the treatment. I give you the one, make this one positive, right? Well, depends on which one is larger. In real life, we would never know this. I mean, that's the whole counterfactual question. The question is now we're going to estimate this. We're going to estimate this quantity by averaging over the relevant population, okay? So what's the ideal, what will be the ideal relevant population? Well, the ideal relevant population will be herself or all her clones. But we know that's not feasible, okay? So what we have in real life, this is just remind people that not only you have these background variables, these including the side effect, but then you also have the outcomes and the treatment 0 or and the treatment 1. You can never see the other one, right? So the real problem here, by the way, from now on I'm going to denote the C the common one. I'm going to actually use a notation is like an empty set, meaning that that's a resolution that we always conditional upon. So we'll just take that as zero resolution. The problem is, not only we do not observe this, we actually do not observe this for anyone. Because for any individual, they only get one treatment. So this is like, in some sense, it's a hopeless statistical problem without making assumptions. Because I have no data. I absolutely have no data. Not only I don't have data for you, I don't have data for anyone. What I do have, right? What I do have is, for different individuals, I can have, they are either at a treatment 0 or at a treatment 1. Okay? So people working in this area say, what's the big deal? We know this, we obviously know this. What people have been doing is taking average here, taking average here, and think that's a difference is a good estimate of this. This is the whole idea of doing all these clinical trials to get the estimate. But I want to remind people exactly what we're doing in terms of this sort of missing data, in a perspective, right? Do I have data for everyone? If I take the resolution is the empty resolution or the common one, yes. I have data for everyone, but it's not very a high resolution. It's like, take an average from a population and a call that is relevant for me. So you probably don't think that's individualized enough. So, well, for all the people who have been treated and treatment 0, we do have their data and the treatment 0. but we don't have the data and the treatment one, and the vice versa, right? The one I really want the condition on is these characteristics that happens in the treatment zero and the treatment one. It is that joint cell that I want to condition on. Unfortunately, I have no data whatsoever. Okay? So what people do typically is to either take an average here, because you know, thinking there, take an average here, compare this to make an approximation, consider that is the approximation here. Oh, by making further assumptions. Okay? So I'm going to use this sort of average notation, right? So what we can do is we can take a population of people who are treated and the treatment zero, we can look at their average success rate for that population, right? So what we know, this is slightly redundant, that if we do the average, that if the resolution set is just your individual, we got our design estimate, but that's just not possible. So the idea, obviously, you want to condition on as many characteristics as possible, trying to approximate that ideal in sort of infinite resolution. But of course, if the C is too rich, if you're trying to measure too many characteristics, what's going to happen is you end up have fewer and fewer data points to a point you have no data. So this is a word that compromise comes in, right? Okay. So now this actually really bears that the philosophical question we were talking about today is it's actually not necessary for big data, but for any data, but big data really makes the problem more sort of pronounced. The notion of frequentness versus space is actually not the fundamental question, although typically we associate them with the following question. The more fundamental question is really, do we want to do coherent joint model, or we want to do incoherent, piecemeal models? I think we should probably flip these two, because this is more associated with the frequentness. This is more associated with the base, right? So in this sort of full base, the notion of full base is we can put down one coherent model of everything you ever want to know. Everything, and no, we put down one model, we make inference from there. Every possible conclusion derived from one model. Therefore, we will not have any inconsistency, right? Frequentist method typically say, I'm going to deal with some estimators. I'm going to do some moment estimator doing this and that. In the end, I'm putting them together. I claim they're unbiased, have lower mean square errors, have more powers. But you tend to lose that coherence. But then in a situation like this, probably the joint model is very hard to do, because essentially it requires you to put a model of this potential outcome. It requires lots of assumptions, probably are not testable, and of course that itself is a philosophical question. So what we're going to do the rest is really trying to at least to the statistician, for the non-statistician, that what are we going to suggest may seem obvious. But sometimes, when you're in a field, when you study too much, the obvious thing becomes less obvious to you, and you think actually is wrong. And there's good reasons that might be wrong. So we're going to actually think about this idea of, in a way, it's incoherent, but in another way, we're trying to use the maximal resolution for each individual, for each treatment possible. Okay. So this is what we call principle to corner cutting. We're trying to cut some corner. We hope it's principle, although we're not entirely sure yet whether it's principle or not, right? So here the idea of the component-wise maximal resolution, which is, remember initially what we really wanted is to estimate the difference between the average at the treatment one and the average and treatment zero. What do we really want? Let's imagine this is the population of all the individuals. These are the individuals that they will share the same, what actually in the literature called the principal strata. These are to say how their outcome and the treatment zero or and the treatment one, not the outcome, all the side effect. But these are the individuals that will be shared the exact same C0, C1 as with me. Unfortunately, I do not observe that. I don't know anybody because I cannot observe those people directly. But what I can observe are those people, for example, for all the people who have treated and the treatment zero, I do have some observation of them. Okay, and this population is larger than that because this is of a lower resolution. This is a lower resolution. So I really want the average only restrict the individual to this population. But I'm going to relax myself. I'm going to use the average among these populations, because this population I can observe something. But this is end of treatment is zero. Now, I can do the same thing for the treatment and the treatment one, right? So again, these are identical. But sorry. These two are identical because these are the, you know, these are the ideal set of people I want to condition my inference on, but I don't observe. I don't know how many people are here. What I can observe for those people who are in the treatment one, if I have, if I share with them the same characteristic as in the treatment one, I would know that that set at least contain those people I really want to share because it's a large set. Okay? So here's the part that may look controversial to statisticians, may be obvious to people who are non-statisticians. Although we want to compare apple with apple, we want to, these two averages to condition on exactly the same set of people, because that would be the apple compare apple. But in estimation, we're going to actually suggest that you take average here using this group, you take average here using this group. Because each one of them, I think I can convince you, each one of them is a better estimator of this than not conditioning at all. The problem is, that does not guarantee the difference of these two is a better estimate of the difference between these two for this purpose, right? Because difference between these two, without conditioning on this, they still condition on the same set of people, the entire population, right? So this is like a resolution zero estimator. This is what we call a resolution actually. This would be the resolution one estimator, okay? So we actually have a theoretical result. This is the thing, I'm not just intuitively telling you this. So this is the funny part, because if you're not a statistician, you say, well, of course, you know, I'm trying to reduce, that should be better. But you have to worry about the difference, because that's what you care about, okay? But there's definitely an incoherence here by condition on, by condition on differently. Okay, so what is the results we have? So later I'm going to use the resolution. Because we use different resolutions, sometimes one side estimated is resolution 1, the other side estimation resolution 0, therefore we will call the estimate of the difference resolution half, which I take it as simple average. It's not the best thing to do, but we find it's convenient to convey this thing. Okay, so here is what we're suggesting. This is what you want for estimate. You definitely want them to condition on the same set, okay? Because that is the compare apple with apple. But for estimator, because the average of difference is the difference of average, we're actually going to choose different conditioning, okay? And we're going to show you. So basically, these are the all sorts of possibilities. Choosing different seeds, you can have a different resolution estimated. Anytime that you have missing data, you will be doing something a little bit, you know, strange. This one will be not conditioning, this one will be conditioning. So when you do this thing, obviously as a statistician you get very nervous about. You know, your estimate is compare apple with apple, but your estimator is compare apple with oranges. You know, how do you claim any sort of optimality? So here, and I don't have time to do this part, so I'm gonna skip this part. So it turned out that there's a very simple calculation you can do, which we call the two times rule, and I'm just going to take 1 minute to explain this. Okay, so what we want to do is to say, and what condition that seemingly that incoherent estimator is a better estimator into mean square error. Kelly got the results, is the following one. It's a little bit hard, I'm showing mathematics on the next slide, but I'm going to give you this intuitive explanation. It's not a perfect match, but it's the best that we can come up with so far. Is that, imagine that when you condition on something like C0. C0 is, suppose you're giving treatment 0, and therefore you do observe everything and the treatment 0. So what that does is allows you to restrict the whole population only to this population. Okay? These are people and the treatment 0. So the information comes in is by restricting what you average into a smaller group. And the information comes in because you have ways to distinguish these two subsets. Those people had the treatment 0 or those people did not. Now, what you really wanted is to condition on both the side effect and the treatment 0 and the treatment 1, which you don't have. So in what sense that the treatment using that unbalanced one will be better, it turned out that it would depend on if I have the missing data. The missing data are those ones that I do not really have, which is that what their outcome, what their side effect will be end of the treatment one, which I really don't have. It turned out that what's important is that the ability to distinguish these two had to be twice more than the ability to distinguish people in these groups. I have not specified exactly what do I mean by twice, but just bear with me that there is a particular mathematical formula. Essentially saying that the side effect and the alternative treatment should not be that informative for the outcome and the treatment I actually get. If that is a strong signal, then actually you want to use the joint modeling. The joint model is going to give you better estimated if you model correctly. If that signal, if the side effect and alternative treatment is weak enough, weak, we have a particular definition, is about half the size, then you can just do this individualized one, take this incoherent difference that actually in terms of mean square error is still a better estimator. It's a biased estimator, okay, compared to the other one. The other one is unbiased estimator, but this is a biased estimator, but it has smaller variance. So in terms of mean square error, overall, you get a better outcome. So that's the, so there's a specific formula, I'm not going to scare you here, but there's a particular formula to define internal regression coefficient, and exactly there, this two. We're still trying to find a better way to explain this results, because it's just a little bit harder to see all the mathematics we're trying to rewrite, so the work is still ongoing. So now let me conclude by just return to this stone size example, and I want to actually test the audience your intuition. Suppose this is Miss Payne, and she get an X-ray before the treatment, and that's actually common when it goes to you get. And let's say the doctor finds she actually has a large stone, according to whatever the definition is. Okay, she has a large stone, and the doctor also has a pretty good knowledge that if she takes the treatment B, the stone size is not going to be reduced because the treatment B was not known to reduce the size. So now you have a partial information. You don't know what's going to happen for Miss Payne if she takes treatment A. But you know that if she can take treatment B, the size of her stone is not going to be reduced. Okay? You can take the doctor's words for it. So you have an additional piece of information. The question for you now, given this data, now if the doctor has access to this data, this was a clinical trial, these were the post-stone size. Okay? If you have no stone size information whatsoever, right? Okay, you may say, well, I'm going to take treatment B because this is a clinical trial, right? All the stone sizes should be balanced, and this was the post treatment size, which shouldn't be conditioned on directly. Okay, but now the question is talking about individualized medicine, right? The doctor took X-ray. Found you have a large stone, and the doctor also know treatment B was not known to reduce the size. So the doctor tells you that after the treatment, you will be in this cell. Okay? Now the question for you as an audience, if you're suffering, what treatment you're going to take? I have this partial piece of information. Of course, I'm going to show you all solutions, but I think this is actually a good point to just open this sort of discussion, because this is the whole point of think about individualized medicine. Think about you do have that partial piece of information. What would be your choice?
Should I still choose B because I think B is better in this randomized? This is a resolution zero. This is unconditional. Not conditional on anything else, right? Of course, in real life, you will have other measurements. But for this data set, say there's no conditioning. This is just what you know. Or should I actually say, well, since I'll be here, and probably since my size at the stone, you see, this is where the joint information is important, right? If the doctor say, well, the treatment B and the A and the B tend to react very similarly, in a sense that if my size is going to remain large and the treatment B is going to remain large and the treatment A, then probably most of the problem is going to jump to here. Okay? Even that is not exactly right, because these are also including, or in this case probably, as long as the treatment does not increase the size, it's probably okay, but if the treatment can increase size, these will also include people pre-treatment with small size, after the treatment they get large size. So that's not exactly right either, right? So should I use this number, or should I use this number, or should I be more creative to use some diagonal numbers, right? One idea would be, well, why should I use this, right? Because any treatment with B, I know I'm going to lack size, so it'd be 69%. Okay, not entirely right. And the treatment A, I have no idea what it would be, therefore I'm going to use this. Therefore, the seems like, you know, it's going to be 9% of reduction. Right? Should I ever compare? This seems like a complete wrong comparison because you're not conditioning on the same thing. But think about the information you have. That was unbalanced information. The doctor only tells you what's going to happen for you after treatment B. And should you completely ignore that information? Let me see a raise of hand.
But in treatment A, the large stone, if it didn't get small, would not relieve the pain, and therefore you would take the treatment A because your best chance is to remove the stone by the operation.
That would be a sensible real life answer to it. But of course, you don't know what treatment A does. I mean, you know, treatment A could be some kind of local anesthesia. I mean, it doesn't really matter whether the size is large and small.
So isn't one the operation, the other one is...
Oh, no. I already switched the treatment here. Remember?
I'm sorry.
Right. This is the second example. The treatment is about relieving the pain, not about the remove the... Yeah, for that purpose. So how many of you... Just think about yourself. Okay. I'm Andy. Just use this as a discussion. How many of you think about your suffering this stone and the information you got it from the doctor is exactly what they told you? How many of you will go with treatment B because of you're trusting this one? Raise your hand. One, two, three. How many of you say, I'm gonna take this because I'm over here and, you know, so how many of you? Yes. I'm not telling you anything. Real life problem. I'm saying the doctor just tells you whatever. This was a randomized experiment. You should go to treatment B. Robin says you should go to treatment B because it's a randomized treatment, right? And I told you these are post-treatment stone size. So Robin will go to treatment B. How many of you will go to treatment A? The rest of you never suffered a stone, so you're not making any decisions. Okay. So how many of you will say, I have no idea? Now, there's one argument for this particular data set. Somebody would say, I'm going to take A, because once I'm here, look at all these numbers. No matter where I am, it's larger. That's not exactly right either, because you still have to keep in mind, when you are here, this only says your pole size is large. Remember, your pre-size was large as well. And these people here, you don't know whether they're both pole size and pre-size are large. You only know their pole size is large. Okay? Now, of course, under the assumption, and the additional assumption, treatment never increases size, it would be safe. But these are additional assumptions, right? Okay, so what's my point? Let me finish, okay? So, this is the resolution zero estimator. If you believe that, you will take a treatment B, but you're completely ignoring the information here, right? And the difference will be, you know, 5% chance of being better in the population, right? The resolution 1 is really this one, right? This is resolution 1 because you're conditioned on one size, okay? And if you believe that one, then you will be doing A, but then we also know this is using too much information because you don't have information here, okay? So the one we suggested, which is really this cross-diagonal comparison, right? We'll still end up with the choice is A, and I'm going to quantify what do I mean by it. But quantitatively is different. Quantitatively saying this actually really have a higher chance to be even better. But then, of course, you know, statistician is going to scream at me and say this is nonsense because you're. So let me qualify my statement. What we say here is that if it turns out the size of the stone and the treatment A is a weak predictor of the relief of the pain and the treatment B, weak in a very quantifiable way, as the Messerman formula. Then what I'm claiming is this estimator taking that difference as an estimator of the ideal difference. The ideal difference is 10001 and the treatment A and the treatment B. This difference is compared to this estimator, which is an unbiased estimator for unconditional inference. This one is biased, this one is biased, because for the one really conditioned on what I am, this one is biased too. Okay? These two estimated, this diagonal ones, and the weak predictor assumption is actually a lower mean square error predictor than the one everybody would say, well, that would be a safe one, right? That's a randomized one. Okay? Except that one only tells you what happened for the population. It doesn't tell you much about your individual. That one said that population is relevant for you if you completely ignore the fact you had a large stone size to start with, you will end up with a large stone size, end up with large stone and the treatment B. If you want to take these assumptions into account, really think about your individual one, there is a condition which may not be a far-fetched condition, because I'm talking about the size and the A is a weak predictor for the treatment and the B. Okay? And that assumption, this mathematical statistic, you can prove it's a lower mean square error predictor. Okay? That's all I want to talk about.
To the
last question is really, you know, it's the resolution issue. Okay?
We take maybe just a question or two while we change this here. That's fascinating, but I wonder if we shouldn't take this lesson as an argument against investment in big data. The reason I say that is that the data here are cheap because you're looking at post-treatment stone size. You're trying to draw inferences about what you should do based on that data. But you might argue that that's the wrong data.
Mm-hmm.
What you ought to do is try to figure out what the treatment stone size is and see if that's what you need.
Right.
It's no longer big data. It means now that you have to rely on more expensive data, but more informative data.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's a argument against the big data. It's an argument. Let me see. Well, there's people collect data anyway.
Right.
People collect it anyway. But what that says is that when you have all these big data, that if you're asking these questions, you do need to think carefully about it.
Yeah, oh, I agree.
Right. You think carefully about it. And there are things you can do that it seems like wrong. But if you just think carefully, what really happened here is the side effect at treatment A. People say, well, how could the side effect of treatment A predict anything about the outcome of treatment B? But the side effect of treatment A is actually a reflection related to your health status. That's why it's related to the other ones.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So there are the information you can borrow. So in a sense, it's really saying, in the big data, you probably can look for more of those informations that is related, but if this information is weak enough, it's okay for you to do this individualized, compartmentalized analysis. It's incoherent, but practically maybe cheaper, and it also may be more robust because it does not make the assumption of that the join, you know, join a counterfactual outcome.
Okay, let's thank Shelley again.